Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and our dear guest speaker, as always, in the studio with us, Sheikh Javid. Well, we are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei, and we were talking about some of these issues and questions and comments. Sheikh Javid, you know, in one of the earlier programs, when you were talking about some of the 12 invalidating agents for the prayer, you mentioned that, you know, eating or drinking while offering the prayer is rendering the prayer void, right?
Sure.
So the question is, sometimes it happens that some particles of food are left in the mouth, like between the teeth.
Yeah.
All right. What about those if one swallows the food intentionally or unintentionally?
Yes.
Does that make the prayer void?
The food particles which remain around the teeth or in your mouth do not make your prayer void, even if you intentionally swallow those particles or those food, you know, ingredients left in your mouth. Of course, your prayer is not made void.
I see. What happens to the prayer if, you know, a person eats something like a piece of bread forgetfully or by mistake? Will his prayer remain valid?
The question of forgetfulness or mistake is something, and eating something deliberately and intentionally is something else. Now, if you happen to eat something unintentionally and forgetfully, knowing that not knowing that you are actually praying, then, of course, according to His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, the prayer is not made void, and you can still carry on praying.
I see. Okay. Sheikh Javid, is it permissible to pray with one's eyes closed, as I've seen in some people doing it in some of the Muslim countries?
You're right. Well, you know, of course it's permissible. It's permissible to offer prayers with your eyes closed, with your eyes closed. But, and I have seen many people who close their eyes or shut their eyes for better concentration, because they think that, okay, if I have to concentrate during prayer, I have to shut my my eyes so as not to see things around me or people walking around me. I should not see, because some people have problem concentrating during prayer.
Yes.
And in order to concentrate, they choose to close their eyes. But the religious authorities have said that closing your eyes is makruh. It is reprehensible.
Yeah.
It's reprehensible.
Yes.
And that's why we should avoid closing our eyes no matter what. We should avoid closing our eyes no matter what the circumstances. Okay. Of course, concentration is good, and it's highly recommended to concentrate. But for concentration, in order to be able to concentrate, we are not supposed to close our eyes. We should, you know, we should see things around us, and because we are talking to Allah, we, just as you talk to someone, to an individual, you cannot shut your eyes. The same is the case with prayer. You are communicating with Allah, and you keep your eyes open and continue communicating.
What about exposure to air pollution? If somebody is in fear of, like, letting something like a dust, a piece of dust, a particle of dust, in fact, enter their eyes, especially during prostration, if somebody is, like, offering the prostration of the prayer, you know, because the head is, like, down on the muhr,
right?
Or to the, in fact, to the soil or to the ground, then some particles of dust may come and enter their eyes. If somebody's scared of this, or the air pollution, which is the dust particle in the air, hovering in the air.
You're right. If there is dust, if there is smoke, if there is something, you're scared or you're frightened, at least it might enter your eyes and affect your eye.
Exactly.
Of course, you can close your eyes to protect your eyes.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, for your nice contribution and answers to the questions about the very important topic and the principle of the rules of prayer, in fact. according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. And if you have any questions and queries, you can drop your comments or whatever you think of the program at englishradio@irib.ir. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
In the limelight. A federal judge in Washington ruled on Friday, 18th of February, that three civil lawsuits against former President Donald Trump related to the attack on the Capitol last January were able to move forward, saying that the former president was not shielded by the normal protections of immunity or the First Amendment. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled, Judge Allows Civil Suits to Proceed Against Trump Over 6th of January. Federal judge in Washington ruled on Friday, 18th of February, that three civil lawsuits against former President Donald J. Trump relating to the attack on the Capitol last January were able to move forward, saying that the former president was not shielded by the normal protections of immunity or the First Amendment. The ruling by the judge, Amit Mehta, meant that the plaintiffs in the lawsuits, several members of Congress and police officers who served at the Capitol during the attack, will likely be able to seek information from Mr. Trump about the specific role that he played in fostering the chaos at the building on 6th of January 2021. If ultimately found liable, Donald Trump could also be on the hook for financial damages. Judge Amit Mehta's order capped a difficult week for Donald Trump, one in which a judge in New York ruled that he had to answer questions from state investigators examining his company, the Trump Organization, for evidence of fraud. Officials at the National Archives also said that Mr. Trump had taken classified national security documents from the White House to his private club in Florida. The lawsuits, all of which were filed last year, accused Donald Trump of overlapping charges of conspiring with several others, people like his lawyer Rudolf Giuliani, his son Donald Trump Jr., and extremist groups such as the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers Militia, to sow doubts about the 2020 presidential election, culminating in the violent storming of the Capitol. Judge Amit Mehta allowed the lawsuits to go ahead against the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, but dismissed them against Rudolf Giuliani and Donald Trump's son. Judge Mehta ruled that he would consider and likely grant a motion to dismiss from another defendant in one of the cases, Representative Mo Brooks, Republican of Alabama. Instead of moving to dismiss, Mr. Brooks had asked Judge Mehta to allow him to substitute the federal government in his place as a defendant in this case. At a nearly five-hour hearing last month, Mr. Trump's lawyers argued he was immune from being sued because he had been acting in his official role as president when he addressed a huge crowd in Washington at the Ellipse before the Capitol was breached. The lawyers also claimed that Donald Trump's incendiary speech, one in which he urged the crowd to fight like hell, but also cautioned them to be peaceful and patriotic, should be protected by the First Amendment. But in his 112-page order, Judge Amit Mehta ruled that Donald Trump's actions that day had little to do with normal presidential duties like executing laws or commanding the armed forces, and instead concerned something much more personal, what the judge called Mr. Trump's efforts to remain in office for a second term. To deny a president immunity from civil damages is no small step, Judge Amit Mehta wrote. The court well understands the gravity of this decision, but the alleged facts of this case are without precedent. The judge also found that after months of creating an air of distrust and anger by relentlessly claiming the election had been stolen, Donald Trump should have known his supporters would take his speech not merely as words, but as a call to action. For that reason, the judge decided the address was not protected expression. Donald Trump invited his supporters to Washington, D.C. after telling them for months that corrupt and spineless politicians were to blame for stealing an election from them. Retold that narrative when thousands of them assembled on the Ellipse and directed them to march on the Capitol building, Judge Amit Mehta wrote. Each of the lawsuits was based in part on a Reconstruction-era law known as the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871, originally intended to protect former slaves from abuse by local officials, but became a vehicle for challenging official actions more broadly. The lawsuits, which seek civil damages, are separate from the Justice Department's sprawling investigation into hundreds of people who took part in the storming of the Capitol, and from a parallel congressional investigation into machinations by Donald Trump and others to overturn the election results in the weeks and months leading up to 6th of January 2021. To date, Donald Trump has not faced a subpoena from either the Justice Department or the House Committee investigating the Capitol riot. But the ruling on Friday created the likelihood that Mr. Trump would have to provide documents to the plaintiffs or even sit for a deposition. Above all else, it's about accountability, said Joseph Sellers, one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. Representatives for Donald Trump did not immediately respond to requests for comment. While most of the accusations in the lawsuits came from Justice Department court filings or from publicly available information, Judge Amit Mehta highlighted a few allegations in his ruling in particular. He wrote, for instance, that Mr. Trump's former close advisor, Roger Stone, may have served as the link between the former president and various extremist groups. Judge Mehta pointed out that shortly after Roger Stone posted on social media in December of 2020 that he had met with Donald Trump to ensure that he continues as our president, he also spoke with Enrique Tarrio, the leader of the Proud Boys at the time. The judge also noted that Roger Stone was guarded on 5th of January and 6th of January 2021 by members of the Oath Keepers militia. Much of Judge Mehta's ruling was dedicated to analysing Donald Trump's 75-minute speech at the Ellipse, one in which Mr. Trump and his audience seemed to be engaged in a kind of back and forth. The speech, Judge Mehta wrote, showed a call and response quality to the president's communications, of which the president would have been aware. The complaints contain numerous examples of the president's communications being understood by his supporters as direct messages to them, he added, and in the case of the 6th of January rally, as a call to action.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, parenting pathology. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of parenting pathology in the Islamic lifestyle. One of the issues that we see in the Islamic lifestyle, especially when we talk about the family and the family life, we see that we are unaware of the parenting pathology. And if we are unaware of the damages or the dangers which is waiting for the family through the training maybe, or through not training the kids, or do not being attentive towards the importance of the training, there are many, many things that can happen and it can destroy the structure of the family. Therefore, it is very necessary to be aware of the parenting pathology in order to have a good family life and in order to raise the kids in a good way or train them in the best way. Therefore, it is necessary. And when we talk about the parenting pathology, there are different things under this topic which we will explain, inshallah.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of parenting pathology, and we said there are different things that come under this topic. And the first thing that we should be aware of it is the loss of the authority of the parents over their kids when they are training them or raising them according to the Islamic teachings. There are many times that we are unaware of such loss, and therefore when our kids are at an age where they need us, where they need this religious training, where they need us to teach them the Islamic teachings, and when we are not paying attention towards them,
Later on, this authority that we have over them, under which we can teach them the Islamic lifestyle, under which we can make them someone who has been raised according to the Islamic teachings, this authority is lost. And they're no more following us. And this is a big damage to the family lifestyle, especially to the Islamic lifestyle. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Britain has sought to restore its influence and colonial rule in West Asia by pursuing aggressive and interventionist policies in the region. UK's first direct military involvement, the 21st century, began in Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks. UK officials beat the drums of war. Then Prime Minister Tony Blair, who was referred to as George W. Bush's poodle, played a key role in paving the way for UK's militarism. It has now emerged that British forces committed war crimes in Afghanistan. Documents show senior military officers buried evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. UK Special Forces officers killed unarmed Afghans who posed no threats. In 2003, London followed Washington's lead in accusing Iraq's former regime of possessing weapons of mass destruction.
So that was the UK's role, was to provide cover for the Americans. And of course, the Americans, the UK sees America as a means of getting a sort of protection, getting the big brother on their side, which they've, following on from their experiences in 1945. The British establishment have a terrific fear of being left on their own to face a major continental enemy.
The UK, alongside the US, invaded Iraq without the UN mandate. British forces were primarily stationed in southern Iraq. British soldiers tortured hundreds of Iraqi detainees between 2003 and 2009, but no action was taken to hold the British government accountable for the war crimes that it committed there. Following the invasion of Iraq, an inquiry team was set up to investigate Britain's military intervention in the Arab nation. The Chilcot report said the UK chose to invade Iraq before peaceful options had been exhausted. It also said the former UK Premier, Blair, exaggerated the threat posed by Saddam Hussein. It also said that Blair ignored warnings on what would happen in Iraq after its invasion.
We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted. Military action at that time was not a last resort.
London is one of Saudi Arabia's staunch supporters. UK-made weapons are used by the Saudi regime against the Yemeni people. The UK is one of Saudi Arabia's leading arms suppliers, along with the US. It is also a major supplier of arms to the United Arab Emirates, another country in the coalition that is bombing Yemen. The UK has continued to support airstrikes by Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners. It has provided both arms and ongoing maintenance and support in spite of overwhelming evidence of repeated breaches of international humanitarian law by the coalition.
Well, its colonial interest is historical. I don't believe that anyone is trying to get Lawrence of Arabia back into the peninsula anymore. I don't think the British, even the most purblind British, don't think they can recreate the empire.
The UK-made equipment used in the war includes Typhoon and Tornado aircraft, Paveway bombs, and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles. The published value of UK armed licenses for export to the Saudi-led coalition since the bombing began in 2015, in March, is £8.4 billion. However, estimates showed that the real value of arms to Saudi Arabia is over £20 billion, while the value of sales to the coalition as a whole is over £22 billion.
Such hideous weaponry, and we are actually inviting oppressive regimes and dictatorships to come and buy this weaponry, knowing that it will be used against the people of Palestine, knowing it's going to be dropped on the heads of the people of Yemen, is appalling.
It is now believed that given the U.S. withdrawal from the West Asia region, or minimal presence, the U.K. is moving in to replace the U.S. while pursuing to restore its colonial influence and role in the West Asia region.
Around a month ago, Israeli media reported that the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, has increased its drone activities in Israeli airspace. The drone operations were mainly for gathering intel. Last Friday, the Israeli military activated the Iron Dome and scrambled fighter jets, but failed to intercept a drone from Lebanon. As a result, air raid sirens were sounded in the north, and later it was announced that Israeli fighter jets were spotted flying low over Beirut. Hezbollah later released a statement saying the drone named Hassan entered Israeli airspace on a reconnaissance mission at a depth of 70 kilometers for around 40 minutes before returning untouched. This was the second incident in as many days and comes after Hezbollah's Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah said the group was making its own drones in Lebanon. Pointing to Israeli threats, the Hezbollah chief said the enemies only threaten others with war, but they know it will be very difficult and costly for them. He said Hezbollah is capable of upgrading the quality of its rockets to fend off Israeli threats. In fact, Hezbollah has been increasing its fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles, and now it is estimated to have some 2,000 UAVs. Based on Israeli media reports, Hezbollah is also in possession of over 100,000 rockets, and Israel's existing missile systems neither are capable of intercepting such a number of missiles and rockets, nor can protect Israeli settlers. The launch of the radio-controlled aircraft on Friday seems like a message from Hezbollah. Even if the Israeli military sometimes manages to shoot down Hezbollah's UAVs or drones, the resistance movement can keep sending them into Israel at will. If Israel believes it is free to violate Lebanese sovereignty with UAVs and fighter jets, Hezbollah will do the same south of the border.
It is interesting to see how fragile its entire military industrial complex actually is, and the latest event has just showed it once again that even though the Israeli regime is investing so many efforts in its so-called defense, it remains very weak, and it is the Lebanese resistance that continues to show the Israeli regime its own weakness.
Previously, retired Israeli General Yitzhak Brek warned that the Israeli military is not ready for any future war, especially a multi-front one. He predicted that in an extreme scenario, the resistance movements in Syria, Yemen, and Iraq, as well as Hamas in the Gaza Strip, will launch missiles and drones at Israel, so that the average number of rockets fired at the regime will reach 3,000 a day. Add to it reports during the Israel-Palestine conflict in May, when Israel's official military data indicated that the Iron Dome only destroyed fewer than half of the rockets and mortars fired by Hamas and Islamic Jihad resistance movements toward Israel. Therefore, in case of an all-out war, the Israeli regime would be vulnerable. While Tel Aviv sees its power waning, the resistance front has managed to increase its prowess. This is while Israel is trying to sell the Iron Dome missile system to Arab nations, but how can the Iron Dome work for them when it did not work for Israel?
This is why the entire existence of the so-called State of Israel in its current form necessitates the ongoing killing of people and ongoing expansion of its military complex. While at the same time, of course, it remains fragile. This is a very existential contradiction within the Israeli colony that eventually will also probably lead to its to the fall of the apartheid regime and the Israeli hegemony, supposed hegemony in the region.
The editor-in-chief of Rayal Yom newspaper, Abdel Bari Atwan, says a small drone that is worth only $100 manages to penetrate into Israel's airspace, despite the Tel Aviv regime's costly military equipment and the Iron Dome system. He says Persian Gulf Arab states that are racing to buy this system from Israel should give it a second thought after the regime's failure against the Hezbollah resistance movement's drones. World leaders participated in the 58th Munich Security Conference in Germany, which is held annually. This year's conference was dominated by the Ukraine crisis, as major Western powers accused the Kremlin of zeroing in on an imminent invasion of Ukraine. In the conference, the U.S. Vice President, Kamala Harris, announced that Washington and its allies will impose significant and unprecedented economic costs on Russia if it further invades Ukraine.
We will impose far-reaching financial sanctions and export controls. We will target Russia's financial institutions and key industries.
Harris also added the U.S. will not stop with economic measures, but will further reinforce the eastern flank of NATO. Harris said some 6,000 additional service members are already deployed to Romania, Poland, and Germany. The official also noted that some 8,500 troops in the United States are on high alert. Also, another high-profile attendee in the 2022 Munich Security Conference, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, said Britain could block Russian companies from raising capital in London and has passed legislation to widen sanctions on Russian businesses and individuals if the country invades Ukraine. Johnson also stated that Russia would pay a heavy military price if it invaded Ukraine. Britain has already sent hundreds of troops to Poland to support NATO's eastern flank. However, the chairman of the Munich Security Conference, Wolfgang Eisinger, has highlighted the need for dialogue to resolve the differences. He said our world is in danger, traditional certainties are crumbling, threats and vulnerabilities are multiplying, and the rules-based order is increasingly under attack. He noted that the need for dialogue has never been greater. Meanwhile, Russia has time and again denied any intention to invade its western neighbor. It argues that it's deployed the military near Ukraine's borders to protect itself amid NATO's eastward expansion. Also, in a major step toward de-escalation, last week Moscow withdrew some of its troops near the Ukrainian border after completing military exercises. The U.S. President Joe Biden has ramped up his rhetoric against Russia amid mounting tension in Eastern Europe. He once again repeated his claim that Washington had intelligence showing his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, has made up his mind to invade Ukraine.
We have reason to believe the Russian forces are planning to and intend to attack Ukraine in the coming week, in the coming days. We believe that they will target Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, a city of 2.8 million innocent people.
Speaking at the White House, Biden warned that war will close the window for diplomacy with Moscow. Biden also said Western countries won't deploy troops in Ukraine, but will continue to bolster their defensive capabilities. Earlier, the White House said Washington and its allies are working on a sanctions package in case of a Russian invasion. This is while Italy says the bans should not target energy imports from Russia. This could throw the EU economy into mayhem or even negatively affect Russia's gas supplies to Europe. The EU is Russia's biggest trade partner. Nearly 38% of Russia's exports went to the EU, while over 36% of Russia's imports came from Europe. Russia is also the origin of 26% of EU's oil imports and 40% of EU's gas imports.
I don't think Russia cares so much and worries so much about Western sanctions, because Russia proved for the years, in spite of Western pressure and different sanctions, capable to sustain and even improving slowly, not so good as before, its economy. So sanctions are not the main threat to Russia.
The U.S. accuses Russia of planning an attack on Ukraine, but Moscow says that is not true. Therefore, the latest warnings, based on unfounded accusations that a Russian invasion of Ukraine is just around the corner, would further complicate the situation at this critical time.
The Australian government announces a plan to blacklist the whole of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas. The country had previously designated Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, back in 2003. Under the new restrictions, which will go into force in April, financing or providing any support to Hamas will be criminalized, with some offenses carrying a 25-year prison sentence. The reason for the blacklisting is what Canberra calls the group's, quote, hateful ideologies. But let's dive deeper and learn more about the Gaza-based group. Ever since Hamas scored a landslide victory in Gaza's parliamentary elections in 2006, it has been running the besieged enclave. Protecting the strip has been one of the group's core responsibilities. Over the years, it has carried out the responsibility, the most recent instance of which came in May 2021, during the Israeli military's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip. The war killed some 250 Palestinians, including 66 children, but only 12 Israelis. If it weren't for the deterrent capabilities of the group, the number of Palestinian casualties would have been a lot higher. How would this justify branding the group as a terrorist organization? The case in point is that any group whose ideology goes against that of the U.S. and its allies is hit with such allegations. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem condemns Australia's decision to list the movement as a terrorist organization and calls on the Australian government to present an apology to the Palestinian people. He said the planned move attests to the biased support for the occupying regime and emboldens Israel to press ahead with its aggression against Palestinian people. The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Resistance Committees were also among Palestinian groups denouncing the decision. Voices of condemnation also came from inside Australia. The Australia-Palestine Advocacy Network, a national coalition of Australians who support Palestinian rights, disagreed with the designation, saying that it does nothing to advance the cause of peace and will only create more suffering for the 2 million people currently living under the 15-year Israeli blockade.
The word terrorist has been essentially coined and put into circulation by Zionists to demonize the people who are resisting their genocide in Palestine and the people all over the world who support that resistance. And in fact, the actual meaning of the word terrorism is deliberately targeting civilians to create fear or terror. And that is a military tactic that has been used since time immemorial by all sorts of different forces.
All in all, in the absence of any meaningful support for the people of Palestine and the condemnation of Tel Aviv, Israel continues to commit gross violations and gets away with murder.
In the limelight.
The real threat against the U.S. is that of detached politicians who are amassing wealth, fighting for power and prestige, while their countrymen and women continue to go hungry, says Ramzi Baruth, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden's real challenge is not Russia or China, but poverty in America. Here's the story. Mainstream U.S. media continues to celebrate the supposed strength of the U.S. economy. Almost daily, headlines speak of hopeful numbers, sustainable growth, positive trends, and constant gains. The reality on the ground, however, tells of something entirely different, which raises the question, are Americans being lied to? And for what purpose? U.S. economy grew 1.7% in fourth quarter, capping a strong year, the New York Times reported. U.S. economy grew 5.7% in 2021, fastest full-year clip, the Washington Post added. Reuters, Voice of America, the Financial Times, CNN, MarketWatch, and many others all concurred. But if that is the case, why then is U.S. President Joe Biden's approval rating at an all-time low? And why are many Americans literally going hungry? In a national opinion poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos and published on February 3rd, only 41% of U.S. adults approved of Biden's performance in office. A whopping 56% disapproved. The numbers were not a complete shock as the downward trajectory of the Biden presidency has been in effect soon after he moved to the White House over a year ago. The truth is, Biden was not the Democrats' top choice nominee for president. Judging by various opinion polls and the early results of the Democratic primaries in 2020, it was Bernie Sanders who represented the Democratic hope for real, substantive change. Party politics, liberal media insistence that Sanders was not electable and fear-mongering regarding a second Trump term in office pushed Biden through the ranks of nominees to be presented as America's only hope for salvation. While Republicans remain committed to Donald Trump's legacy and are still largely politically and ideologically united, Democrats are growingly unconfident in their leadership and uncertain regarding the future of their democracy, governance, and economy. Of course, they are blameless in holding such views. While the Democratic leadership continues to obsess with its fear of Trump, and while liberal media insists that the U.S. economy is as healthy as it can be, the average American continues to struggle against encroaching poverty, inflation, and lack of future prospects. Here are some of sobering numbers. 56% of all Americans cannot produce a meager $1,000 as an emergency expense from their existing savings, CNBC reported. 1 in 10 U.S. adults have gone hungry last December as a result of poverty, Forbes.com reported. Columbia University Center on Poverty and Social Policy revealed that child poverty rate in the United States stands at 17%, one of the highest among developed countries. If American workers are studied separately from the larger population, the numbers are even more grim. Three-quarters of American workers said that it was very or somewhat difficult to make ends meet, according to a study conducted by Shift Project and reported in NBC News Online. 40% of the polled workers said they're not able to come up with $400 in emergency money. But the most shocking of all, according to the same study, is that around 20% said they went hungry because they shouldn't and couldn't afford enough to eat. Aside from occasional government handouts, which were provided by both the Trump and Biden administrations, little has been done by way of structural changes to the U.S. economy that would ensure greater equality among all sectors of society. Instead, the administration's priorities seem to be allocated to something else entirely. Writing in Politico, David Siders describes the current political discourse within Democratic Party circles where Democrats are losing their minds over 2024. Since the Democratic president's public approval ratings are dismal, Democrats fear the return of Trump. All anyone can talk about is Trump, donors, policy folks, party insiders, and the media. Siders quoted a Democratic advisor as saying the same advisor described a weird cycle where the conversation keeps coming back to Trump. Whether conscious of this obsession or not, the Biden administration seems to operate entirely according to a political strategy that is predicted on tarnishing Trump and his supporters, retelling over and over again the story of the January 6th insurrection, hoping for a Republican split or any other miracle that would bolster their chances of maintaining their congressional majority in the next November amid term elections. While doing so, the Democratic leadership seems oblivious to the harsh reality on the ground, where food prices are skyrocketing and where inflation has reached unbearable levels. According to new data released on February 10th by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the U.S. Consumer Price Index, CPI, rose by 7.5% in January compared to the same month a year ago, making it the fastest annual pace since 1982, the Financial Times reported. The rise in inflation is not a one-time-off event, as CPI has been rising at a sustainable level of 0.6% on a monthly basis. Ordinary people can feel this increase almost every time they go shopping. Small business owners, especially restaurants, bakeries, and grocery stores, are left with one out of two options, either increasing their prices or shutting down completely. Consequently, large segments of the already vulnerable U.S. population are growing more desperate than ever. To avoid providing real answers to difficult questions about the welfare of millions of Americans, about the real function of their democratic institutions, and about existing corruption within the U.S. political system, regardless of who controls the Congress or resides in the White House, Democrats and their media are either blaming their Republican rivals or creating foreign policy distractions.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zayed Al-Salami.
A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. We know that when it does come to the topic of charity, we hold it this topic very close to our hearts, because we want to be as human as possible with our feelings. And Islam does encourage us very much to be not only compassionate, but stand in solidarity with those who are around us who are not as fortunate as you and I. And that's why sadaqah is given in different levels. Depending on your financial capacity, depending on what it is that you are able to do or have. And that's why we said that there are many applications of sadaqah. Doesn't necessarily need to be money. For example, you are in university and you know that there's a poor family and the poor family can't afford to have a tutor. You tutor their children. That's the best form of sadaqah, like all the other very, very good forms of sadaqah. So we need to expand in our understanding of what sadaqah represents. And all of it is for the sake of other people who are around you. You want to elevate their status in the society. You want to improve their welfare. You want to make sure that medication is facilitated for them, or water, or anything else along those lines. And of course, that's really, really heart lifting. You know, it does really give you that motivation that you need. And that's why there are many effects for sadaqah. And we did say that sadaqah repels evil. We did say that sadaqah removes a bad omen from you, removes your nuhusa. That sadaqah will increase in your rizq itself. You know, the more money you give away, the more money you're going to receive. Subhanallah. And that is that whole element of you having that unconditional faith in alamul ghayb, in the realm of the unseen. That because God is telling you to do it, you're doing it, and you're leaving the rest for God. You have absolute tawakkul ala Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's the perfect thing about all of this. So Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, he says, وَالْبِرُّ وَالصَّدَقَ السِّرُّ يَنْفِيَانَ الْفَقْرِ. Birr, righteousness, and giving out charity privately, يَنْفِيَانَ الْفَقْرِ, will repel poverty, will keep poverty away from you. وَيَزِيدَانِ فِي الْعُمُرِ, being righteous, giving sadaqah, will increase in your lifespan. وَيَدْفَعَانِ عَنْ سَبْعِينَ Mitata su, and it will repel, it will keep you away from 70 different kinds of bad deaths. Subhanallah. An sab'een mitata su. Another hadith, it says that if you wake up in the morning, we mentioned this before, if you were to wake up in the morning and pay sadaqah, you won't have nahs, any kind of nahs for that day. And if you sleep in the night time paying sadaqah, you won't have any nahs for that night as well. And of course, there are many, many examples. Important thing for us to remember is, لَن تَنَالُ الْبِرُّ. You will never attain righteousness, حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا, until you pay مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ, that which you love. What do you love the most? Everyone loves the most, and as far as the dunyawi side is concerned, is money. And therefore, you won't be able to attain righteousness until you pay, you give away that which you love the most.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است چه فرون نماز این قصاب داره فرون روزو هم باشه.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فرون درخت کاری اینجا کم ثواب داره دعا هم داره ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
Imam onturi ki ro gofte varam gofte de un imam ki gofte agar roze begiri sawab dare hamun imam gofte ki agar darakht bekari un sawab dare.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment.
وقتی میخوای کشاورزی کنی یه قدر گندم بگیر رو به قبله بیست این دعا رو بخون اینم همون امام گفته دیگه.
When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
That's why in the Holy Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala continues to speak about, you know, how important it is for a person to continue on with this important practice of sadaqah giving. It needs to be like a daily routine. It needs to be something that you do regularly, not only for you, your family members as well. So you teach your son, you teach your daughter from a young age. You say, okay, well, there's that poor person over there. Here's some coins, go and give it to them. So they learn from a young age to keep be aware of there being poor people around them and helping them and doing charity work and things like that. You will extinguish the wrath of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by paying sadaqah. Your lifespan will increase. Your wealth will increase. Sicknesses will be removed away from you. You will be free of calamities. Istanzilu rizqa bisadaqah, Rasulullah says, that expect rizq through paying sadaqah. Rasulullah also says, laysa min muslimin yatasaddaqu bisadaqatin illa min tibin. And as I said, you need to give it out of goodwill. The Holy Prophet says, you're not a Muslim if you give sadaqah and it's not out of goodwill. And if you do so, illa wada'aha fi kaffi ar-Rahman, فَيُرَبِيهَا لَهُ حَتَّى يَمْلَأْ كَفَّهُ. So as I said, it's going to reach the hand of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And I mentioned this hadith in the previous episode. Then we know that it is going to repel evil. Dawu and sickness. The Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, Dawu مَرْضَاكُمْ. Medicate your sick people. Give medication to your sick people. How? بِالصَّدَقَةِ. By paying sadaqah. So sadaqah is a form of medication for the sick. وَدْفَعُ الْبَلَاءَ بِالدُّعَاءَ وَاسْتَنْزُلُ الرِّزْقَ بِالصَّدَقَةِ. And repel misfortune through dua. And receive or expect rizq by paying sadaqah. You want rizq, you pay sadaqah. You want to get rid of a sickness, you pay sadaqah. Of course, then another application again for sadaqah is waqf, what we call an endowment, what we call sadaqah jariyah, so ongoing charity. Sometimes you give someone some money, okay, that is something that they're going to spend and it's over. Sometimes though you want to give sadaqah jariyah, which will mean that its reward is continuous, even when you are in your grave. Its reward will continue to come back to you. And there are many examples of sadaqah jariyah. If you were to build a well, that's the best sadaqah jariyah. If you were to build a hospital, that's the best sadaqah jariyah. Especially if it's a charity hospital, that's the best sadaqah jariyah. Walhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. Wa salatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children's screams.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time.
IRIB English Radio.